When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. There is an incredible facility right here in downtown Toronto that is helping on the front lines and is doing incredible innovative research. They are a facility that treats everybody with dignity, and they need your help. May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. If this matters to you, help CAMH. There's no better place for your resources. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand and donate now. Help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Sometimes good things do happen in this country, and the return of the kids in the hall is undeniably and objectively and empirically a good thing, a wonderful thing even. All the more wonderful still for the fact that it's good. The new kids in the hall is good, and it's just so wonderful and gratifying to see the whole world remembering how great they are, because it's not like the CBC doing some half-assed thing. It's on Amazon, and it's gone out to all of comedydom and all of streaming land, and the sketches are weird, and their bodies and faces are weird, and it's funny, and I'm gushing and I'm fawning, as I did when I spoke to a few of the kids in the hall. But there's so few episodes of this podcast that are motivated and fueled by me liking or even loving something. And I just love these guys. And I love Bruce McCullough. Listen, over the years, I've spoken not only to Bruce McCullough, but to other Canadian celebrities, Mark McKinney and Scott Thompson of the Kids in the Hall, Sarah Pauly, Jay Baruchel. And will we call him a celebrity? Sure, I guess he's a celebrity. George Strombolopoulos. These conversations are part of this show's history. They're interesting conversations to listen to today. And if you'd like to listen to them, what we've done is we've put them in a special playlist for supporters of this show. If you are a supporter of Canada Land through Apple, check your subscription, because these playlists, these packs of our kind of greatest hits interviews with celebrities are there waiting for you to enjoy right now. This will mean nothing to a lot of you, but it means the world to me, and it meant a lot to me to speak to Bruce McCullough. And we don't have a new show for you this week, and it's summertime, and why not hear my conversation from 2019 with, I don't know, maybe my favorite kid in the hall, Bruce McCullough. Wait for it. This episode is brought to you by Alex Corbett, Allison Peters, Lucas Porter, Aaron Smith Avendano, Carol Fagan, Anna Vina, Ragini Srinivasan, and Siri.
My name is Siri Arnott. I am a closed caption editor living in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, and I support Canada Land because I want them to have enough funding money to keep making such kick-ass original content. I really like how well they change with the times when they need to, and I'm getting a great education about the important issues in my country.
Hey, quick note before the show begins to let you know that we have found a new host to The Backbench, our excellent show all about Canadian politics. If you want to find out who that person is, we are very excited to share that news with you, and we're going to be able to do so a little bit later this week. Here's how you find out. Subscribe to The Backbench. That's where we're going to be sharing that information. Go subscribe right now. I think that you might be as excited by this news as we are. Welcome.
Bonjour.
This is an ambush.
Yeah.
You and I have a deeply intimate relationship that you are oblivious to.
Okay.
I'm making this weird. Let me try to explain myself. Kids in the Hall debuted on television when I was 11 years old.
Yep.
And Brain Candy came out when I was 18 years old. So you have an outsized role in my development.
course. We're your daddy and your mommy.
Yeah. It's a difficult thing to explain to people, some of the people on our team who you just met, when I said, this is a big deal to me that Bruce McCall is coming in.
They said, why?
Why? And I had trouble answering that question. I don't mean to offend you. To the extent that they knew you at all.
He's no Sean Cullen. I've heard it before.
He's a guy from a comedy show. What is the big deal? And I've been struggling to, like, what is the big deal? I've had Scott here and I've had Mark here and we've had great chats, but right. I still have difficulty figuring out what, like, it really opened up something or it formed a lens through which I saw the world. And I have noticed that there's a divide where people who kind of were part of that and understand that and people who are just kind of baffled by that.
Right.
Maybe you being one of the people in the Kids in the Hall can help me work through this. Maybe you have some insight into this.
Well, perhaps you had an alcoholic father. You know, I think that we are or were still are people who kind of are weird little outsiders who said the world's okay and we're all going to be okay and we can make fun of ourselves and society is fucking wrong, but we're not exactly sure how. Mm-hmm. And I think as someone who didn't fit in, perhaps, I'm just guessing, I mean, you clearly run your empire here with an iron fist, but as someone at that age who didn't fit in, it might have been like, wow, these people have a different kind of brain than I do.
That gets me part of the way there.
It might be also surreality. Like I find my son is that age that you've described, which is like he loves the Tiny Meat Gang or whatever. And he's 12 now, but we connect on like the weird idea and there's something comforting in those weird ideas. Like I would tell him about 30 Helens Agree and he would like laugh because it's you're thinking something that you don't think someone else thought of or there's not something obvious about it. And I find that that brings men especially together or people with weird searching brains.
Yeah. And the surreal aspect, I think, was something that you really brought into the...
Well, I think I mostly love it. I think we sort of shied away from it actually a little bit because we all loved Python so much and they were the great surrealists.
Yeah.
They were the Magritte of comedy. But yeah, it ages well too. I found like a weird idea is evergreen.
A lot of it ages well because you weren't doing like parodies of pop culture.
Yeah, no, we didn't barely existed in pop culture. Things that don't age well is we do a scene about an answering machine and they don't exist anymore. But like, it's not like we're, you know, going, damn you, Petrocan.
You pitched 30 Helens Agree to Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
30 Helens Agree.
You can't pay too much for a good pair of shoes.
Sensible shoes make sense.
I spend a lot of time on my feet, and these make it a lot easier.
My God, your feet are what you walk on.
30 Helens Agree. You can't pay too much for a good pair of shoes.
I couldn't see it working on Saturday.
Well, of course not. I went there, and that was part of the reason that I fell so in love with the Kids in the Hall, and I didn't realize how much I loved them, like a rom-com, until I ran to them at this 80-minute mark, realizing that I'd always loved them. I went to New York thinking that there'd be the great brains of our generation were there. And they were in a way. I met Madonna and Timothy Leary the first day there. But the people there had a different weird sense of humor that wasn't as weird as ours.
These are like Harvard kids.
A lot of Harvard kids and a lot of just kind of intellectual humor. We should do some stuff about the original first Thanksgiving and do things about muskets and stuff. And I just thought, as a promo that 30 Helens Agree that Saturday Night Live is pretty good.
Yeah.
Felt beautiful to me. And I got lectured.
So that is like the holy grail if you are aspiring in comedy to be discovered by Lorne Michaels and to go to New York and to meet the biggest celebrity in the world. And basically like this is the launch pad. Like the stakes just couldn't be higher. Like a lot of people flame out or you're the next huge superstar.
Right.
And it didn't go your way.
Well, yeah, because it's about being in a band. Like sometimes when you know all those super groups, none of them are very good. You know, when you get the bass player from ELO and the whatever, like we are an entity, a brainiac entity, the Kids in the Hall. And in fact, we're all often weaker when we're on our own. We're often less like ourselves when we're on our own. And I think we didn't understand, or I didn't understand, the intrinsic chemistry and kind of a circle of comedic love and respect that we had. And I think I just didn't fit in there. And I'm like, I can't help myself. Like I've directed studio movies or whatever, but I'm I'm not really the guy who wants to please everybody. I kind of want to please myself, and I can't help myself, you know? And I think that was part of it. I think I failed more than it failed me there. And I didn't fail because I had some fun and wrote some okay stuff. But out of that, I was more fortified that the kids in the hall should do a show, which is lucky that Lorne Michaels thought that too.
Yeah, his line on this ultimately was he realized that like he discovered this troupe that he loved, but then by splitting them up, it didn't work anymore and they're stronger together.
Without question.
And then continued to champion you once the band was back together.
Yeah.
I think maybe you also had to not only be together, but maybe something about the combination of you and Canada.
I think so. I mean, he ultimately took us down to New York to toughen us up, which didn't work. Like, it was just sort of lonely and sad. I think there was something about, you know, the chemistry of me and Mark meeting in Calgary and battling the sort of the homophobia and whatever, the brown shoes culture I thought existed there, and coming to, you know, the greatest city in the world, which is Toronto. And of course, I want to come here more because the Vile Tones were here. And I think ultimately there's something about Toronto that made us what we are.
Yeah. I mean, later when Mark McKinney was doing Chicken Lady on Saturday Night Live, that didn't work either.
Well, as Lauren said about him at that time, it's like he didn't want to be in the pictures. When you're a young comedian, you're happy to be in the picture. I think he kind of wanted to keep doing sketch comedy, but I don't think his heart was really in it.
Yeah. The Canada thing, I think, is a part to me figuring out. It wasn't just the surrealness. It wasn't just the absurd. And it wasn't just like, oh, here are some fellow outsiders. Like, when you think about different sketch comedy troupes, there's some kind of theme, like, to the extent that Chappelle's show was about race, or Baroness von Sketch is about women in a way.
Owning their bodies at a certain age and looking at the world.
And like just like getting at it in a way that journalism can't, just sort of like character sketches and trying to understand something about like the way people speak to each other and relate and what's funny about the way we present ourselves. Each troupe kind of has, you know, I think Python, everything that was silly underneath the kind of stiff upper lip of British. So what is your thing? And I look at it and, you know, I was used to Saturday Night Live. Saturday Live is about, I think, skewering popular culture and parodying popular culture. And then there's this show that, like, I'm seeing in the little Super 8 films, whatever, like, places that I know.
Right.
And then these characters that I meet in the sketches are, like, you know, secretaries and businessmen and dads, bad drunk dads, cool dads with earrings.
Right.
And yuppie dinner parties and pretentious record store clerks.
Right.
And I'm like, this is my world. I know each one of these people. I've met versions of these people, and no one has ever put their finger on it. They've always just sort of been some generic kind of thing that's sort of like American characters. But there is something specific about not just Canadians, but like white Canadians.
Yes.
Like, it was like the most thorough study of like white Canadian manners.
Right.
And all of the repression and like the secret desires and lust and anger underneath this kind of like very banal exterior.
Correct, Amendo Potsy.
Did I get it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think as I look at, you know, great TV, even like Seinfeld, which is kind of silly, those are people processing their obsessions. We were processing our obsessions and our lives. And yes, Scott would come to work in his underwear. He'd wear his underwear on the subway and get mad that people were staring at him. Like, there was something about the immediacy of coming to work and something you see on the street, or your girlfriend pissed you off, or you pissed off your girlfriend, that we would write about, which was sort of just our common, it was just our world. And of course, you think it's kind of boring because it's your life, or it's a version of your life, or something you think of. Of course, Cancer Boy isn't my life, but it's like, it's ideas you see as you walk through the world. And if you actually own your show, because no one at Saturday Night Live owns the show other than NBC and Lorne and whatever, like they're all trying to score and they're all trying to get things through the gate.
Yeah.
And we had our own show. Not many people have their own show. And not to plug my new show, but Tall Boys I'm working with, and goes like,
you work hard. You play hard. And as a TPOC, tired person of color, sometimes you're required to tolerate hard.
Let's talk diversity. Who would like to start us off? Chris?
I'm just an intern, so.
When you're tired of having another exhausting conversation, reach for All Day Tolerate.
Well, Gene, as the only black person here, I'd love to chat about diversity or any other racial issues.
When is it okay to touch a black person's hair?
Excellent question.
Here's how it works.
As ignorance enters your ears, your brain naturally produces anger, placing undue stress on your last nerve. All day tolerate shuts down your production of woke teens and equizymes, which fortifies your ability to endure.
What do you people want?
I don't know. Good morning, Tom.
Whether you've been asked to speak for every person of your race.
We've been lied to a lot.
Or having dinner with your girlfriend's conservative parents.
If you ask me, Islam's a real threat to this country.
You know I'm Muslim, right?
What's that have to do with Islamics?
So Islam is a religion, so rich in history.
When you can't stand them,
all day tolerate them.
I'm gonna need a second.
Not for you.
There's 2,000 comedy sketches or troupes. Only 3 have their own shows. You can be picked to be on other people's shows, but to have your own show and to have it once when you're young and you're in the middle of your young man's spell, as they would call it as in the art world, is pretty amazing.
There's something about that, too. The timing of it is because you're saying, OK, we're putting our own lives. We're reflecting. But you were so young and that show was so well observed. It wasn't just your own lives, like how you understood women so well, how you kind of like even like the class mobility of it. Like you could do a dinner party where somebody's just like murdering someone or the affair. And then you could do like you could do kind of like white trashy stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
I went to bartending school everyone. For you. Yeah.
Or where you're trying to beat up the big guy. Yeah. You did a lot of characters.
Yeah.
Did you know what you were doing at the time?
No, not really. And I think, you know, and it's funny because I go through this with the tall boys who I'm working with. It's like they're thinking about what they're doing. And it's like sometimes you just have to paint and then step back and look at the canvas. Because if you're interested in something, it's maybe interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and I, in my own life, and I've had some success and some failure in terms of studio movies or whatever, or when I've tried to write a movie that I thought everybody would love, it doesn't work out. And so we never tried to figure out something that would succeed. We never thought of that. You know, I'm sure there was the third Cabbage Head maybe isn't as good as the first or whatever. But in a general way, it was only what was interesting to us.
Yeah. And I can't imagine it was an intellectual exercise like, you know, what are some other white Canadian stereotypes for us to skewer? Like you just sort of like would channel these things and it kind of works or it doesn't.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons that we never broke up is we didn't talk about comedy. Right? We didn't go, well, comedy's a rule of threes. Like, I remember once when my first writing gig was writing the Gemini Awards and Eugene Levy said, well, yeah, but what's the button? I thought, button? What the fuck's a button? And like, so we didn't have the intellectual breakdown of comedy material.
Yeah.
Like Mike Myers famously does where he draws graphs of things and what people want and where they get them and stuff. We would just go, oh, you know, I've been asked to sort of teach sketch comedy writing. I don't know how to write sketch. Like I've just written a million of them. And so I think there's such an instinctive part of it that we followed and got lucky that we got to follow it.
How many comedy podcasts have you appeared on dissecting comedy and how it works at this point?
Not many.
There's an interest, I guess, in the autopsy now. Like people want to get in, you know, conversations with
comedians. Yeah, I mean, I think the part that's interesting to me is like that it's a different cultural entry point now. Like when we started, it was Second City and the Frantics had a radio show that was a big deal. Mm-hmm. And Second City was really corny because of the music and those dumb chairs. And we made it up. And now the culture has changed that you can actually be in a band or you can be in a comedy troupe. And maybe being in a comedy troupe's easier and cooler than being in a band. That was never something that was offered to us. You know, we are like the weird people in Wilburn, Saskatchewan, trying to find a New Yorker. That like, wow, what is that? And so I think that's the thing that has changed probably in the 25 years since we started.
I have known a disproportionate number of punks from Edmonton.
Right.
What is it about Edmonton?
Have you been to Edmonton?
I've been to Edmonton.
It's Edmonton itself. It's the, you know, used muffler capital of the world. Who wants a used muffler? You can get one in Edmonton. I think it's just a tough little town.
Yeah.
And it certainly, you know, Calgary as well has turned into quite a great city. They were pretty kind of asshole, kind of cowboy places when I was there, which they've transformed themselves. But I think there's something sort of cold and, as you say, white and kind of turgid about Alberta.
Yeah. And maybe you couldn't be like a little bit of a punk in Edmonton. Like in Toronto, you could kind of be like,
Oh, no, you couldn't be a punk in Edmonton. You'd be beaten up by
– Well, that's it. I knew the punks I know from Edmonton were like – they were doing the anti-fascist thing before it was a thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and if you were a punk in Edmonton, you had to be prepared to fight. I don't think – if you were a punk in Toronto, you didn't have to necessarily fight. You could if you wanted to. You know, you could always go to Gasworks and get your ass kicked, but, you know.
You might have trouble finding somebody to take you up on that. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp, therapy online that has served over 3 million people around the world, and it's available here in Canada. And this time of year, we're all emerging from our winter like seclusion and, you know, patio season and socializing, and it can be terrifically fun, but it can also create a lot of pressure. And some people get like anxiety, social anxiety from being out too much. What did Iggy Pop say about social life? It's torture dressed as fun. It doesn't need to be torture. I think it's just about finding like the right balance of how much of other people do you want? I mean, we need each other, but I think that at a certain point, it can become overwhelming. And talking to somebody about yourself, about your social life, about your relationships is a way of gaining insight into what is right for you. It's not selfish to examine that with a professional. And as the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Listeners of the show get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's better, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. This episode of Canada Land is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. We got a tour of their facilities in their downtown Toronto campus, and I was blown away by the heroic work that these people are doing. They are saving lives every day. I know people whose lives were saved, and they just really care about the dignity of the people who turn to them for help. Look, we talk a lot about these issues on Canada Land. We talk about the crisis that is claiming 20 lives every day in Canada to drug overdoses, but we don't give you a lot of options of what you can do about it. CAMH is an option. CAMH desperately needs resources that they directly put into their work, saving lives and turning people's lives around. Listen, May 6th to 12th is Mental Health Week. This is when they need your help the most. Go to camh.ca/CanadaLand to help CAMH treat addiction and build hope. Let's talk about doing what you did in Canada and sort of what happened afterwards. Like, screw you, taxpayer.
Wow, what a bad sketch. And in such poor taste, too. You know, we're going to get a lot of telephone calls and letters about this one. And why not? Because every Canadian has a right to complain about that sketch. Because every Canadian owns a piece of that sketch. You see, your tax dollars feed into the government, which in turn mandates the CBC, which in turn provides funding, both whole or in part, to shows such as ours. So, like a cupful of water poured into an ocean, the atomic particles of your tax dollars mix with the whole and wind up providing for the budget of the show, for the budget of that sketch, and for this piece I'm doing now, which we call...
Screw you, taxpayer!
Like, these are not things that you could have gotten on to the CBC before you guys, or after.
Right.
It's unthinkable.
Right.
Was it just the power of Lorne Michaels?
I think we just kept going. Like, and I think no one stopped us. And I think that there was a better cultural sense of satire then than there is now. Obviously, there's a seriousness on every joke. It's looked at from three angles, not just is it funny. And I think, I think the momentum of us going kept us doing those sort of things.
There was a real punk aspect to the show.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't do Running Faggot now. But of course, then it was beautiful because it was about a folk hero, right?
Yeah.
It was the guy who'd been beaten up, me, in Calgary 12 times for being a fag, was making him a folk hero. I don't even know if you could have that conversation now. It's a different, as we say, climate.
Yeah, no, there was an undercurrent of like, it was a fun, very funny show. It was silly at times. Sometimes it was even wholesome. Like, these are the days I know, or 30 Helens of Greer. Kind of, but there was anger. See, that was the thing, too, is I think that why it resonated in those formative years with me is not just like, oh, I see a mirror that reflects my world, but it was a fuck you. It really was a way of looking at Toronto through like, now I see you, you're exposed to me. And you know, I kind of think of like Kids in the Hall and 8-Ball, the comic book, were things that really where, you know, it's sort of like, I guess some people could watch Kids in the Hall and say, I want to do that. I want to be a sketch comedian. But that wasn't the takeaway for me.
Right.
It was more just like, now I have like a framework.
Well, that's nice. Like I didn't listen to Lou Reed and think I could do that.
Yeah.
I just thought, wow, that works for me.
Yeah. It was like a band. I saw you guys. I was at a taping and like that was electric. Like the Shadowy Men played and it was so fucking loud.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, guys, you should turn it down a bit.
And then you all came out wearing suits and just like really, I know that some comics will have like somebody to come and just get the audience amped up, but you did it for yourselves. And then you taped like a classic episode. You were nowhere but there to see that happen. It was weird after you were done to see these benign, anodyne, inane CBC sitcoms where it was so safe and tepid. And my thinking is like, how could the same broadcaster that did that now be doing this?
Well, they give you a half hour. They don't make your show for you. So that's the thing. It's like, how do you get on the air? And, you know, every show on the air is a miracle. We got on, we kept on, and are sort of loved and hated because it was actually our success in the States that kind of probably kept us going here. Maybe, I don't know if we would have done 5 years here if we hadn't sort of been doing well in America.
If the HBO version hadn't.
Yeah.
Kind of encapsulates so many things about Canada, too, that you needed that cosign and that momentum to keep going and probably to have power creatively. But the show is so Canadian at the same time.
Yeah.
And then Brain Candy, which is weird to me to read you saying, like, I don't know if you were referring to the experience or the movie, but you said something about how shitty Brain Candy was. And to read about the commercial failure and the critical failure, I was just a teenager who saw it and thought it was great.
My thing about Brain Candy was it was really a product of, if you're having a bad time, I think it kind of shows in the footage in a way. There's been famously horrifying recording sessions that made great records or whatever. But we're not Sly and the Family Stone going down hard and coming up with a great record. I think we were having a tough time as a group. And it just wasn't so much fun. Our show was fun. And I think there's so much pressure on that. We rewrote that so many times. And I just remember looking at a call sheet that said, all calls add 5.5 hours. Because it was just slow and hard. And it was it's sort of beautiful for its pain, I suppose. But it was really physically and mentally painful.
I mean, I clocked that it was dark, but that felt like a natural progression. Like I didn't want a movie-length Kids in the Hall episode.
Well, I mean, that is the brilliance. It's why we called the book One Dumb Guy, or Paul did, which is we didn't even think what our movie should be. And everybody was going like they were waiting for Chicken Lady to show up and the head crusher to see his lair or whatever. And no, we just didn't. No, we're not really doing characters from our show except Cancer Boy. Hey, how's that for an idea, guys?
when my friend saw it before I did, I said, how is the movie? And he goes, one word, Cancer Boy.
Hello.
Hi, doctor. I'm Cancer Boy.
And what would you like to say to the doctor?
I'd like to thank you for your marvelous drug.
Oh, are you on it, Cancer Boy?
No, there is no hope for me. But my parents are on it, though. They were so very low, not just because of me, but because my brother was born with his heart on the outside of his body.
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
That's the thing that kind of went into that territory. Like, I can't believe they did that.
Right. And Cancer Boy is so sweet. And I cared about Cancer Boy so much. And so, like, there's heart and soul behind it. Like, we never pick a target. We've never picked one target in our entire careers. The target is us. The target is society. The target is poor people who are trying to get Wayne Gretzky to come see their kid because he's got cancer and he's in remission, so maybe Wayne doesn't show up. Like, that's the impulse for that.
I heard you on Marin saying that kind of killed everything because you fought like hell to keep Cancer Boy in the movie and you won the battle but lost the war because the studio gave up on the movie because of this cancer.
And boy. I was taught, I don't know if I taught myself or the streets of Calgary and Edmonton taught me, I was just taught to fight for my shit.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I'm working with a young comedy troupe now who are kind to each other, who don't fight with each other. They want to take care of the other person even more than themselves. And we didn't come from that. And I'm probably the pugilist of the kids in the hall, most in the troupe. So Scott's pretty crazy too. But it was like, you just fight for your shit. And as a punk, you just fight for your shit.
I had this thought, like, in those years where it was like just kind of this desert, and it seemed like we weren't producing good comedy in this country. I'm like, this is so, to return to the CBC question, like, they keep making these sitcoms, and I don't know that they've ever made a sitcom that I've liked, but they sure as hell have made a great sketch comedy show. And then Canada had SCTV, and I know that there's sketch comedy going. Like, we do that well. Why don't we do the thing that we do well? And where, like, these are in years where I wasn't sure what all the members of Kids in the Hall were doing. I'm like, why don't they get those guys and make them the executives of comedy at the CBC? Like, it's cheap to make. They should be scouring this country. Like, let's fix CBC comedy right now. If CBC just had, the same way Netflix has like 10 new or 20 new comedy specials a year, if CBC was just platforming different sketch comedy troupes, they would be doing their job of reflecting different people. I don't know. Like, it feels like that's the thing. And now that's what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I think they want to do that. I mean, executives just wait for things to come in through the door. And sometimes they want to do something. They have an impulse. Like, we all know that right now, there's never been more great sketch comedians and solo performers and weird stand-ups and queer stand-ups. And, like, there is 1,000 great people in Toronto right now. And I think probably as an executive, you go, like, I don't know, how do we organize this? And the reason I got to do the Tall Boys, or the Tall Boys got to be on CBC, is because I'm an organizing principal. I saw them, I thought they were super talented, they were soulful, they were smart. And I went to CBC and I said, I can do this. I can organize these guys. They're very green. They'd only had 10 sketches at that point. Mm-hmm. I see their talent. I see the thing. I know the journey they're going to have to take. It's extreme heavy lifting to figure out a show for people. But you're right. There should be way more. There should be some at Bell. There should be some on every network. And you're right. It's easy to try.
You're Lauren Michaelsing them.
No, because I have to actually direct. So that means you have to show up at 6 a.m. Well, in the way that Lauren got us a situation that we could flourish in that way, I would respectfully say I'm Lauren Michaels.
Yeah. If your subject matter and the truth that you brought was like reflecting this world of repressed white Canadians, it seems like from the first two episodes that I've seen, something about being young and something about what's changing in Canada, something about multiculturalism, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, without question, multiculturalism. And they're socially very serious about their place in the world and how the world is shifting. And I love this for me, to be an old white man, to be part of that, to be helping them have their space and their voice. And we connect just through, you know, soul and comedy and surrealism. They're surreal. I'm surreal. So there's lots of ways to connect.
We're around the corner from the Rivoli, where you famously kind of just worked through it all and just had this rigorous work ethic of coming back week after week after week, sometimes playing to 10 to 15 people. Is that missing these days? Because I think everybody just wants to make a YouTube video immediately and have a show the next week.
I don't think that's missing. I think we've gone through a phase where everybody wanted to make little short videos to, I think, live performance is probably more important than it's been in many, many years. You know, I do the Moth storytelling thing sometimes. 2,700 people in Portland listening to 5 people at a mic tell a story. And, you know, and if you go to the clubs, you go to UCB in LA or Comedy Bar here, wow, there's a lot of people working, doing 5 shows in 3 nights. So I think it's out there for sure. People don't expect to get a special. It isn't like, you know, all their friends' writers got development deals. It's not that. I think they know they're plugging away for each other.
You exist between these different worlds, and you've sold pilot after pilot in Hollywood and directed feature films. That comes with frustrations and things not getting picked up. Canada seems to just have a big loving embrace for you and the other members, where you can kind of come and do other kinds of weirder work here. Has it worked out?
Yes and no. Like, I don't know that's true. I mean, it's hard. Like I say, every show that gets on the air is a miracle. There's not an unlimited amount of space for things. And I've developed things that don't end up on the air. I've done that in America and I've done that in Canada. You know, America, you can always find another buyer. If Fox isn't interested in you this year, you go to Netflix. Canada is mostly CBC now. Bell is always trying to do stuff, but tend to not do as much stuff. So it's still hard, but I'm at a point in my life where it's really great to be back in Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think in the smallest way, I've been rewarded for that.
You live here now.
Yeah, but I've only been here now for a year. I was in LA for 18 years.
And returning, like, is it – the market is less, like you're saying. There's less options.
It's a couple things. It's, you know, we sort of had said to my wife that we would always be back by the time my daughter was in high school, which was now. And I think it was actually culminated in my one-man show, which I'm not plugging, the death of my good friend Gord Downie. And it was like, do what only you can do. Do the blues. Don't write a script that you get paid well for and then you can sit in your place in the hills for a while. Like, just work. Just do stuff. And I think there was something about needing to get back to Toronto at whatever age, you know, I decided that it was important to get back.
I feel like there's a tension in that sense of like place and wanting to be here and wanting to own it and develop it, and also a sense of frustration about the limitations of it. Is that still active for you, or like you kind of don't have anything to be frustrated about?
Like, well, everyone's frustrated. It's like someone said, what's it like to be a Canadian icon? I go, well, I could use a job, eh? Like, you know, it's all
– right.
And it's the thing. It never – nothing ever ends. Nothing's ever different. Like – trying to come up with a sketch when you're in your 50s is the same as when you're in your 20s, or someone going like, no, I don't like that, is always the same. So I'm a worker. All I do is work. I get up, I have an idea, I push it around. Somebody likes it, somebody doesn't. It's a tweet, it's a New Yorker story, it's nothing. Like, all I do is work, and that's the joy of it. And so I don't think so much about, and maybe I spent too much time in my 40s doing that, like going, ah, how come Fox isn't doing this pilot? I thought they liked Molly Shannon. Now I just work. And then as I did in my 20s when I got my great success, and out of that comes the reward.
And what about the anger that kind of fueled it to begin with?
Still angry. I mean, I'm a happy man. I've luckily put together a much better family than the shitstorm I crawled out of. But there's so much to be done always. And like my connection with Gord Downie, my connection with the blues, you got to keep doing it. That's why I don't want to retire. I just want to keep doing it. And whether I'm performing in Waterloo for 300 people or whatever, that's great. We're having the conversation. I'm laying it down.
Do you think what Lorne Michaels thought about the five of you is still true? Are you better together?
Without question. You know, I mean, the realities of life is we decided not to become UCB and start our own company, and they didn't take my two-page proposal that I'd made in the early 90s of how we could become our own community and our own entity in a larger way.
Wait, what do you mean?
Well, I just thought that we could be what UCB has become, like get a building, get a space, develop things for us, other people.
That's a fucking great idea. Like it would be, there'd be classes.
We do shows, we do stuff, market, teach class, you know.
All kinds of stuff developed. Become an institution, basically.
Yeah, we were taught, though, and SCTV went through the same thing. We were taught that after your show is over, you're supposed to scatter and get a role, get a thing.
Yeah, cash in your chips.
Cash in your chips, that you're out of university, now you're going into the real world. And I think that we realize now, and SCTV kind of realized that now, and a lot of comedians, even ones that are in Saturday Night Live, realize that, no, we needed a home. And that's what Lauren always says. Artists need homes. And when you're on your own, just, you know, talking to Michael Gruber, your agent at William Morris, it seems like you're doing something, but that's not your home.
I think you should still do this Kids in the Hall institution, building, school, performance space.
Okay, well, buy the old Second City that they're going to tear down.
Okay, let's talk about it. That's what the next phase is, right? It's like growing up, it's like there needs to be a fuck you period, but then when you start your own family and try to make it better than the one you came from. Or I don't know, something about becoming the man.
We're workers. I don't know if we can actually build the institution.
Yeah.
I think the thing we do with Inside, whatever it is, and do it the best and find our cracks and find a show to get onto CBC and find another one to get on, you know, a Netflix or whatever. I think that's the way we do it instead of trying to be Netflix.
All right. Well, I think we figured this out for you.
Yeah, good.
I don't know what I got, you know.
Well, your anger and perhaps sexual repression drove you to enjoy the Kids in the Hall somewhat.
That'll have to be enough.
It's always enough.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Jesse.
This episode originally aired on September 9th, 2019, and was originally produced by Jordan Cornish, Kasia Mihailovich, and Kevin Sexton, hosted by me, Jesse Brown, and re-edited for rebroadcast by Cassidy Villaburn-Barakas. Hey, as mentioned, we've got other Kids in the Hall interviews, Scott Thompson, Mark McKinney, as well as a whole bunch of other celebrity interviews for our supporters ready to go from our archives. So if you want to become a supporter, go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in the show notes, and you can listen to that playlist right now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.